This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about recovery with number one bestselling author, Dave Chawner. He's a comic that tours around the UK with a show called Mental, coincidentally, where he shares his experiences of mental illness and particularly experiencing anorexia in a really honest and hilarious way. He was an absolute delight to me, and I'm confident you'll really enjoy hearing his insight in the episode. I was also particularly glad to focus on anorexia in terms of talking about recovery, because I certainly feel, both from my own experience and those people I know and have had the privilege to interview, that it is an extremely difficult mental illness to recover from. In my own personal thoughts, I don't actually think it is a condition that you can recover from in the linear sense as you might recover from physical illnesses, which are more binary, where you're well or you're ill, you've got a broken limb or it's healed again. With many mental illnesses, I think even when we do feel recovered, it can leave behind emotional and behavioural scars that are harder to shift. And I think anorexia is one of the most intense in that way, or eating disorders in general, because they so change your outlook and your whole relationship with food, even when you are recovered from a healthcare perspective, in that you're maintaining a normal weight for your height and your age and other factors like that, even when you're eating with the regularity and routine that doctors would expect, your relationship with food is still changed. Certainly with myself, my eating habits are better than they've ever been since developing those symptoms in the first place, and yet that remains something conscious. I don't think you can kind of forget about food one day and just be completely chill with that.
Yeah, it's something you can't avoid, isn't it? Food forever.
It's always complicated. People that do have a healthy relationship with food.
Well, absolutely. It's a thing. So you're absolutely right, actually, when you think about it from an eating disorder point of view, in terms of recovery. There are physical symptoms that people probably do recover from, you know, severe physical symptoms of, you can get better maybe physically, but in your mind and mentally, there's probably always something.
Yeah, I think that relationship is always going to be more complicated with food than someone that's not experienced an eating disorder. That's why I'm particularly glad to be talking about recovery with a guest that's experienced anorexia, because it is such a complicated one to recover from. But we will also be talking about recovery in general of mental illness symptoms that affect all kinds of illnesses, and just in terms of what that process is like universally of getting help and coming to terms with having an illness and needing that help. I think a lot of that insight will be quite universal.
Yeah. The big question is, can you recover from mental illness? So interesting.
It is a tricky one. I think definitely you can, but maybe there needs to be more acknowledgement of the layers of that. Maybe the certain things that will stay with you. And that can be positive and negative. We've talked a lot on the show about some of the skills like empathy that experience of mental illness can give you. And I don't want to recover from empathy.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't be as good at doing this job if I was less empathetic.
And just that internal strength, people that have experienced mental illness, just think the strength that you get from having to deal with it actually is undervalued. People don't recognise how important that is moving forward in your relationship, especially at different ages, younger people go through adulthood having experienced something. If you can get a bit of a handle on it, I think it can set you up in a decent way for all the pitfalls and bullshit, to be honest, that life can throw at you sometimes, you know what I mean?
For sure. I think that's very true, that it can give you a certain resilience. And whilst that may mean you remain more at risk of falling back into symptoms and illness, having been there before, having had, you maybe have a higher tolerance for symptoms that people that have never experienced them don't.
Absolutely. And there's a spectrum, isn't there? Recovery is a spectrum and mental illness is a spectrum. So
I suppose
where we are on that spectrum depends on what's happened to us as individuals and our own personal experience. But you're right. I think there's a, it's an interesting point about that. Resilience is key to that, this discussion, I think.
There's so many different perspectives on recovery. So two of them we have from our research I wanted to share. So first is quite a generic
lazy.
I'm trying to be polite. Quite a generic definition from dictionary.com of the word recovery. They've described it as a return to normal state of health, mind, or strength. And I think that works in a general sense, but we also got a definition from the Mental Health Foundation, which is more specific to mental health recovery. And they've defined that as recovery is about the realization of goals and the development of relationships and skills that support a positive life with or without ongoing mental health problems.
There we go. That's more like it.
I like that. And also that includes a bit of what we've been talking about. They're acknowledging that you can be recovered while still having ongoing mental health problems. And that's quite an interesting perspective that I think often isn't talked about. That you can be high functioning and living a good, productive, happy life day to day, but still experience some symptoms that you work through.
Absolutely.
And that doesn't mean you're not recovered necessarily. And that's why it's such an individual journey for people to learn what their idea of high functioning is.
Yeah. Or normal, as the dictionary like to put it. Depends what we, how we all started. As to where we're at, doesn't it, in our personal journeys and how recovered we are or not. But you're absolutely right. I thought that was brilliant for Mental Health Foundation. And it's true. You're right. You may still always live with something going on. But that doesn't mean that you can't be high functioning and get through day-to-day life and be happy, actually, and still just have a relationship with your mental illness to some degree. Fully recovered? I don't know, but I don't know if I want to be, really.
Well, I think it's actually quite important not to go too binary in it. Mm. That, of course, it sounds great for us all to be that, to be fully recovered. But for many people, that's not the case. And even if you feel fully recovered, that doesn't mean you're immune ever to getting symptoms in the future.
Mm.
So
that's important.
So I think there can be a bit of a danger in trying to make it a binary ill or well system. So I'm glad to be delving into a lot of the ins and outs in today's episode. Before we get into that, we've got a few key facts as usual. So first off, from NHS Digital, they do an annual report on NHS England's Improving Access to Talking Therapies programme, often referred to as IAPT. So that's a program whereby you can self-refer for talking therapies, like counselling, and potentially get access to those therapies quicker than you might do with other routes, or it can potentially save you needing to make the GP visit. You can just self-refer. And that's really exciting progress that's been rolled out in the last few years. So the statistics we found released by them were that half of people completing a course of treatment for conditions including depression and anxiety recovered from their condition. Also, 49.3% of people making a recovery in 2016/2017 represents a 7% increase compared to 2012/2013 when records for the service began. So I thought that was really positive to see the increase in how many people are recovering in what is most of the time quite a short term. Even if it's more, it is a limited number of sessions. This isn't long-term therapy that so often people have to go privately to receive. On the face of it, half of people completing a course of treatment showing signs of recovery doesn't seem that many. But it is potentially quite positive because for a lot of those people, it will mean that they need other support, whether that's a second round of talking therapy, whether that's medication, whether that's seeing a psychiatrist or a psychologist for more in-depth
Treatment.
Yeah. So for people to have short-term therapy and it, half of them show signs of recovery, even in that, I think actually is very positive.
I do, but we said that, you know, didn't when we were talking about this, I think it's positive because it may be people that just start experiencing early signs and early symptoms. It may not be those who are, you know, high level clinically depressed. It may be people that actually are starting to struggle and some symptoms are starting to come through. And if you can intercept a point that actually something can be done with talking therapy, and half of those people are then actually, no, I can deal with whatever I'm going through now and get back to what I was doing. And the other half may need some further treatment. I think that's brilliant. I mean, I'm, you know, me talking therapy all the way. I just believe in it so much. To have somebody to listen without judgment and with empathy, I think is key. And lots of people don't have that. And I think that's it. And this is evidence of that working to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And to me, it also shows why it's so important that the resources grow, because we're very aware on this podcast of the limited opportunities for this type of support, that there isn't enough funding provided at the moment. And there's parts of the country where that funding is very, very thinly spread.
Yeah.
But the positive of it is these findings show how much of a difference it makes.
But it does. And also, I've got to tell you this story. There's a guy, I watched an amazing TED talk the other day, called Dixon Chibanda, who is a psychiatrist in Zimbabwe. And there's only one, he's one of 12 psychiatrists who supports more than 16 million people in the country, 12 psychiatrists. And he just thought, I can't reach people. And, you know, to cut a long story short, he had a patient that needed to travel 3 hours. She couldn't then afford a young girl. She couldn't afford the bus fare to get there. He didn't realise till after the fact to go and visit him after she'd been sectioned in hospital to see him for therapy. And she took her own life, unfortunately, because she just couldn't cope. And he realised that we've got to do more, but there's only 12 of us. So he's actually gone out and trained. He's put a programme together that's called Friendship Bench Programme. And it's actually training grandmothers who are big in their community, like in lots of communities, to understand how to use talking therapy to help mental illness. So there's these benches and these communities all over Zimbabwe with these grandmothers, some beautiful images on the TED Talk, wearing these yellow vests, who are now trained, just that have had short-term training. The benefits of it and the numbers of recovery are just amazing. Mm-hmm. So as you said, the resources are limited, but actually, can we be a bit creative and could we think about other ways of actually supporting somebody?
Right. No, that sounds really,
really
interesting.
Really, really interesting. I think you'd really like it. It's really cool.
So the last thing to mention before we get into our episode with Dave Chawner is a general update about the podcast. We have recently joined a podcast network called Audio Boom, who are going to be supporting our publicity and monetization of the show. So this will ensure that we can continue the quality of the program, keep getting the best possible guests, and reach more listeners than ever before. So thank you so much to all the listeners that have been with us up till now and have allowed us to grow to the point where we can get this extra support and these opportunities. You will hear a few changes to the podcast as a result. The main one for now will be that we have some new sponsorship opportunities. So you'll hear that the segment coming up next, where we normally play our self-care partner, has changed. That is something that we're still getting used to. There will be a lot of change on who sponsors us week to week. And so you'll hear that reflected in how we've chosen to title this new segment. So with that all being said, thank you so much for being a mental listener and continuing to support us. I'm really excited to share the interview with Dave Chawner with you, as well as loads of other brilliant interviews coming up in the next few weeks as we transition into our new life as a Audio Boom podcast. We'll get into that interview in just a moment, but first, our new segment. Who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
I'm Dave. My earliest introduction to mental health, and now that I'm prepared to think about it, it's like kind of odd because I hadn't thought about this in years, but Stephen Fry did a documentary years ago, and I remember it was on like the BBC, and it was all about his bipolar, and I remember we watched it as a family, and I remember like going into school, and loads of people had watched it, and it really affected loads of people, and like a really good mate of mine, Sarah, it really affected her as well, and I remember saying to her like, God, a lot of that stuff like really like hit home, and she was like, yeah, me too, like a little bit too much. And I remember talking to my mom about it, and I'm not blaming her and I'm not having a go, and to be honest, perhaps she was right, but I was like, that thing that we watched last night really struck me, and she was like, yeah, everyone has down days, it's whatever, you know. And I kind of think for a long time I didn't really think about the mental health thing after that, because I was like, yeah, you know what, people just get on with stuff and that's fine. And I think it was like a big kind of motivator for like my mental health kind of narrative, because I was like, yeah, people just get on with stuff. And like now I kind of realize, you know, there's a difference. I always say there's a difference between emotions and mental health. And that's kind of like the difference between weather and climate. Emotions do change 2 or 3 times a day, but your climate should generally be quite temperate. It should be quite stable. The anorexia kind of came much later than that. And like it didn't really start, it more developed. It was something that kind of became a subliminal coping mechanism. You know, I got exams, I got coursework, I got like identity issues, all of this stuff like everybody else has. Some people coped in different ways, like substances, drink, drugs. Other people coped in much healthier ways of like, you know, writing lists or going to the gym or whatever it was. And anorexia just developed over time as my coping mechanism, a disease coping mechanism, but also something that selfishly, because I got a kick out of, helped make sense of the world and me.
And so when you describe it as like selfishly then, is that how you felt at the time, or is that still how you feel looking back?
It's a good question. I'm just very aware of there are people out there that are skeptical of mental health conditions. And instead of saying, no, you're wrong, you're a bad person for being skeptical, I think it's a lot more compelling and kinder to like shifty alongside them and kind of go, yeah, no, I can see why you would think that you should just pull yourself out of it, etc., etc. However, that's not possible because X, Y, and Z. So suppose when I sell selfishly, I still feel quite guilty because I know that not everyone has an eating disorder, and there's that guilt of like, why me? I know that the solution from the outside looking in is very simple because it's just eat. That's like, that is seemingly from the outside looking in, that is the solution. As well, that I did get a kick out of it. I did get a buzz. Other people had to go through all of the shit that I sort of put them through, whereas this was something to a lesser or a greater degree that I kind of got a kick out of, a buzz. It was a real addiction. And I suppose that's why I say it's selfish, because it was something that I am guilty to admit that I did in part and only in part enjoy.
I get that. I do think that's potentially a symptom in and of itself, though. So when we've talked about eating disorders before on the podcast, one thing I've been keen to get across is how when experiencing one, you end up kind of gamifying food.
Yeah, big time.
And how dangerous that is. And so for me, that's when I know I'm not doing well with mine, is that when I've not eaten by coincidence, like I've just kind of forgotten or been too busy or been traveling, and then I feel pleased. That feels like a win.
Yeah, man.
That's when I know I'm not doing so well. Or, you know, when you start like checking the clock and sitting counting the hours between meals, or trying to figure out a way to like skip a meal without people noticing. And it can become gamified, but I think that's very much a reflection of the condition, because when I've been at my worst, even though those are choices you're making, they don't feel like choices. That it doesn't feel like something you have an alternative to, because the alternative feels far too scary to even be an option.
Which is why I think without getting ahead of ourselves, I think you've actually touched on a really good point there. I love that word gamifying, never heard that before. But I kind of think, I absolutely agree. I think you fight fire with fire. And that's why I don't see why recovery should be about taking something away. I don't see why recovery should be boring. Actually, if you can make recovery more exciting, more enjoyable, more sustainable than the eating disorder itself, then everyone's onto a win-win. So I think I completely agree with that. Yeah, with that gamifying thing. I think that's a really astute point.
Yeah, well, the reason I mention it is that I was a bit surprised by your use of the word selfish, because I think it implies that you had control over your eating disorder.
Yeah.
And I think in reality, you only have as much control as you are well. And the earlier you are, the less control you have.
Yeah.
And the less you know about the condition, the less control you have. So certainly in the early days, I would never think to call you selfish, because you weren't in a position to make the rational choices that, like you said, might seem perfectly obvious to outsiders that don't have a condition like this, where they're just like, well, eat them.
I'm much harsher on myself than I would be on other people. And I think that's because you can control your own actions to a certain extent. You shouldn't look to control other people's actions. And I think actually being a sort of tough workmaster for myself helps to try and keep me in check. Because I think it's a really interesting thing to explore. And I don't want to do it inelegantly, but I would really love to look at this idea of, it's your brain stopping that. It's the worry, it's the tension, it's the anxiety, it's the everything else behind it. It's kind of like a car. The engine and all the parts might be there, but if there's no petrol in the tank, it's still not going to drive.
Mm-hmm.
But from the outside looking in, people go, there's nothing wrong with your car, what the fuck's your problem? And they, you know, you can't actually see the petrol tank, you can't see the inner mechanisms that make it tick. And I think that's why I always get a little bit uncomfortable going too much down the route of a lot of my friends go, look, well, you do have control, mate, you do, pick up a sandwich, chuck in your gob, it's easy. But I think that's a kind of misunderstanding of eating disorders, that it's not about the food. It was never about the food.
Yeah, and I'm glad that's why you've brought up control as well, because that's so much of what it's actually about. And that's why it can be so complicated, because on one hand, for many people, they develop disordered eating or a diagnosable eating disorder through oftentimes what they eat being one of the few things they can control in their life. And certainly in those that I know who've experienced it, that often correlates with when they get worse as well. When life's particularly tough because of external stimuli, and then the one thing they kind of snap back to, okay, well, this is definitely something I can control because I've done it before.
Yeah.
And so they come back to the same mechanisms.
At source, you're absolutely right. It's taken me my own weird kind of version of stuff to try and realize that, it is actually about control. But the thing that I didn't realize is that control manifests in different ways. It ain't about, you know, like control over like, oh, I want to get a B for my geography GCSE. It's like, actually, what does that B signify, and why is that so important to you, and what does that mean, and why are you trying to strive for that? Because everything else seems so ephemeral, changing, and like you're on shifting sands, and actually because of that, then you don't have anything to anchor yourself to. And if you can anchor yourself to something that doesn't change, then actually not eating doesn't change.
And if we could go back a little bit, would you mind sharing what led up to your diagnosis, how that came about?
When I was 17, I loved school. I had an absolute ball. I thought it was amazing. I'm still in touch with a lot of my friends from school. And irony is, like, all of these kind of like sob stories that we're told to spin, it was like the opposite. For me, I wanted to stay as a teenager. Like, we just had like a great bunch of people, the most underfunded school in Staffordshire, and I was like the head boy. At that point in time, I started dating this girl, and it felt like everything was coming together. And ironically, I wanted to hold things as it was. I wanted to pour that moment in amber and encase it and kind of keep it forever. And I also felt really torn as well, because if I enjoyed that moment too much, then I would be jeopardizing my future sort of life, because like if I didn't work on like, you know, the exams, like courses for studies and stuff, then I wouldn't get to university. Whereas if I focus solely on that, then I would kind of overlook this beautiful time. And like when I'm like in the 40s, 50s, I'd look back and go, oh, you had it all then. You like absolutely wasted it. So not only did I feel completely torn between enjoying the moment now, but also working towards the future, I also didn't want things to change. And for the first time in my life, I kind of felt like everything had come together and it was only going to be ripped apart when I went away to university, when I left my family, my friends, my job, my kind of everything that I'd got. And then the girl dumped me, and then it just felt like everything was just shit. Like, it just felt like everything was like kind of, you know, typical teenager just sitting there listening to Fall Out Boy and My Chemical Romance, because, oh my God, the world's working against me, man. Teenagers go through different things, but I think my point was I didn't have a coping mechanism. I didn't have emotional regulation. I didn't have emotional intelligence. I can only put these things into words because I've had time to do that. But at the time, it was just a knot of anonymous emotions. And I didn't even realize that I was restricting. I didn't even realize that I was weighing myself 7 or 8 times a day. I didn't realize I was weird. I didn't realize that I was pushing myself further, that I was exercising or taking these things that were incredibly bad for me. I didn't realize that was a problem. It was just a hobby. And everyone kept on saying to me, like, mate, you're really dropping weight. And I was like, look, everyone, you know, everyone's got shit. It's just my little hobby. And that was how it started. You know, I still remember stepping on the scales and like looking at the weight getting to a new low, and you know, just being like absolutely like buzzing, like genuinely the most excited, and like holding back clothes for when I was having a day when I felt confident, or a day that I felt thin, or looking forward to days when I was like fucking busy, because then I'd be like, look, I not only will I not eat, but I actually won't think about it, and I know I'll feel great. And you know, buying a coffee machine and having all of these like 7 or 8 coffees before I get out of bed, and all of these things that like now I realize in hindsight, oh, that's unusual. But because I was doing them, because I'd never lived in anybody else's mind, that it made complete sense.
And when people were picking up on how much weight you were losing and how fast, how were you responding?
Like friends, parents, mates were like coming out to you in the street and going, Jesus, well done. You are looking fantastic. And like for some of my low self-esteem, I was like, oh, yeah, it's just all fun. And I was like, well done though, well done. And everyone kept on saying, no one said you look like you've lost weight. Everyone kept on saying you look good. And by that kind of proxy, putting on weight meant to be bad. And I only wanted to be good at something. So the more weight I lost, surely the more gooder I would become. And also, I kind of defy anyone really sort of to say that they don't like being told that they're good or congratulated on something. And the fact that people were congratulating on me, I was like, this is fucking bitching. Like, I'm 17 and I found the shortcut to approval. It's fucking great.
And so at what point did you realise, or people around you, that this was a bigger problem?
People around me like realised a lot more than I did. Like my mum was kind of crying and screaming up the stairs, like, you're anorexic. I remember standing on the scale. It's kind of like laughable now, but I remember one morning, it was like 8 o'clock, and it was the third time that I'd weighed myself that morning. And I kept on sneaking off because I didn't want her to know that I was like weighing myself. So I suppose I knew then subliminally that it was like kind of a bit weird. But I remember my mum like shouting and screaming, like, you're anorexic at the bottom of the stairs. And I remember thinking to myself, fucking hell, she's melodramatic, as I got out the scales and then weighed myself again. And like loads of my friends kept on like pulling me aside and kind of going, mate, I think I'm anorexic. And I was like, look, if these people are going to make this little thing that I'm doing like a big melodrama, then they're living in the scripts of Hollyoaks or fucking EastEnders. What I'm doing in anorexia, I'm not minutes away from death, I'm not NG tube. What I'm doing is something that I enjoy. And like, you know, you always see pictures at that point in time, like on GMTV, of just like, oh, you know, this woman weighs less than a paperweight. And you're like, well, that's obviously what anorexia is. It's being the thinnest and the lightest that you can. That's not what I am. So people around me noticed a lot earlier than me. And I think...
You've reminded me of an interesting parallel as well we talked about recently, which was how a lot of people with alcoholism that don't realise it yet, it's always one drink more than they're having.
Yeah,
big means time. You're an alcoholic. And I think there's that opposite.
Yeah.
It's yeah. always one less thing that you're eating that makes you anorexic.
Completely. And I actually think with that, I think alcohol's like a real, a brilliant parallel. Because like we still live in kind of a drinky culture. Like, oh, go on, have one more. Oh, he ain't an alcoholic. Or even like in comedy clubs, you still hear it a lot of like, oh, he's a good lad, he's an alcoholic, that kind of thing. Like it's something to be revered. Like it's something that people choose or would in any way be kind of positive. And I think the same is like the sort of saying with anorexia. Like I remember there was a song by Nickelback where it said, we all want to be big rock stars and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And then it says, we all stay skinny because we just won't eat. And that, even hearing that, I was like, oh yeah, I do that. I'm like part of a fun club, you know, and it's, you know.
And I remember the impact that track had when it came out.
Mm.
Like everyone I knew was obsessed with it.
Yeah.
And it's meant to be ironic. It's meant to highlight how ridiculous the music industry is,
yeah.
and the impossible standards of like this crazy life you're meant to lead.
Yeah.
And yet people were running around thinking they're rock stars because they're singing this song and feeling it was aspirational.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the beautiful like kind of ironies of life, is that like hindsight can taunt you so much. Great example as well, I was terrible, have very girly tastes in like comedies and dramas and stuff like that. I used to watch The OC. I was fucking obsessed with The OC, man. And like there was like a storyline where like Misha Barton's character, I can't remember what name, like wouldn't eat. And again, it kind of like sold this thing back to me of like, oh, this is kind of like part of a fun club. It ain't a big, isn't a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think underlying all of that, it kind of like, yeah, it sort of implies that I did know, but didn't really know. Genuinely, if I'm balls to wall honest, my biggest concern was more that I wasn't anorexic than I was, because I think subliminally I was trying to use my body to show that there was something wrong with my brain, that, you know, I wanted help. I just, A, didn't know how to ask for it, and B, didn't know what that help was.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of going to a doctor, and the doctor sort of being like, you know, mate, don't have a Big Mac, you prick. Then that, I genuinely think that would have mortified me, because I was trying to ask for help. And if you get knocked back from that, that's, you know, going to push you further. And I, you know, I did go to the doctor for numerous different things, like my kind of heart palpitations and my constant coldness. I was having like 2 or 3 showers a day. My doctor genuinely said, have you thought of emigrating? And I was like,
wow.
That is, because I didn't present as an anorexic. I just, I was like, look, I'm a bit worried here, mate. I'm in 3 showers, fucking draining the Amazon basin here. What's going on? So
And at that point, you had no idea that
thing, because people had told me it was good to lose weight. So obviously being incredibly thin was being incredibly good. And I was like, well, I'm pretty much, you know, I'm doing all right now.
And in that, it's incredible how much your brain can rationalize mental illness if you're not coming to terms with it. That you were seeing that not as, I've gone too far on this thing and it's no longer good. You were like, no, I'm committing to it like nobody else is.
Yes. Big time. Big time. Hugely competitive nature. And I think we live in a society that increasingly is prolific with calories and BMIs and stuff like that. Like when I was a kid, I don't think I ever saw calories on the front of packs of food. And then they brought in those little wheels and people became, you know, more aware of them, which I suppose to a larger extent is incredibly helpful for the, you know, the general populist, but I suppose...
Yeah, it makes sense. It's also overly simplistic in that the guided daily allowances are set on your gender and not anything like your body size or your ethnicity and factors like that. And BMI has been proven again and again to be inappropriate in measuring people from certain backgrounds where their body type is different in relation to their race. And yet this stuff is used. And I think that's part of feeding into that same gamification when it comes to disordered eating, then, that you can look at a one little metric like calories, which is only one part of the picture of nutrition.
Yeah.
But you're like, okay, how few can I have? And I've known people that have had eating disorders that they've not been dealing with would have 500 calories a day and they were best friends. And so they'd spend all the time together reinforcing this dangerous behavior. And 500 is not appropriate for any gender. Yeah. I'm not even sure how young a child you would need to be to be able to survive safely on 500 calories a day. And yet, even still, that's only part of the picture.
Yeah, and it's weird because, like, for me, it was always about calories. It wasn't about health.
Mm-hmm.
I would eat things that were, like, worse for me, but because they were lower calories, you know, that's a bit fucked
up. And I think that's something that is quite a clear way to spot it in others. You know, there are plenty of people, particularly seemingly around New Year's, that go on the gym kick or go on a new diet. And a lot of that is okay, I think, as long as the motives behind it are okay.
Yeah, of course.
But when it's becoming so reduced down that it's just about, okay, how narrow can I be as a human?
Yeah.
As opposed to, I want the healthiest, leanest body.
Yeah.
And yet that's not reinforced in our media. The airbrushing and the Photoshop isn't about like a healthy glow. It's about how can we shrink this person down.
Yeah. And I think we're getting better at that. And I'm excited to see how that kind of develops, of like plus size models being just generally used. I think,
well, even within that as well, having done work in the modeling industry, the plus size models for the most part aren't plus size.
Yeah, they're UK
in
size
fact
10.
They're usually average.
Yeah.
And yet they're given that plus narrative. So I think unless that changes,
this is one of the things that I explore this a little bit in the show. I don't see why we have plus size. I genuinely cannot see any reason why can't we just call them models.
Absolutely, because the flip side is, if they're plus size, then that must mean all the other models are normal.
Yeah.
And they're not. There are people that can be model measurements genetically, but then there's equally a lot of people that get into the industry and lose a lot of weight to try and achieve a body standard that isn't natural for them.
Completely. All of this sort of stuff subliminally gets entrenched into you for a very early age. And we know that people like Byron had anorexia. We know people like Mary, Queen of Scots, had anorexia. So heavily in the 12th century, the ascetic. It's not something new. And I do worry that with sometimes we get caught up in this whole conversation about like the media and stuff to blame them for eating disorders. I am all for more proportionate representation of people, but that's not going to solve eating disorders, because it's not about looking skinny for the prom. It's an actual psychological condition.
Yeah, I totally agree that whilst that's a factor, it's not always the root cause.
Yeah, big time.
So if we just come back to your story a little bit for a moment. So you'd been to the GP with various symptoms relating to your eating, but not realising. At what point did you find out what was really going on?
I'd been increasingly worried about my eating. I was increasingly losing weight and stuff. But the biggest thing that I think that pushed me happened in 2009. I basically was, one of my mates called me up out of the blue. And over summer holidays, there are these summer camps for kids around the world. So like boarding schools and stuff open up their doors to kids from Hong Kong, like India, France, Germany, Italy, and they come over here to improve their English. And then they get university students, generally they pay them pittance to live there, work there, do 20 hour days for like 5p an hour. and, you know, sort of teach these kids. And I got offered to do one of these. And it was brilliant. It was so much fun. And at that point in time, it was 100 quid a week to work 7 days and board with the kids and work with the kids. And the shifts were 7 in the morning until, well, if you were on bed duty, 11:30 at night. It's like 100 quid. That's amazing. So I like joined. And this was down in Bruton in Somerset, the deepest, darkest place. And the reason this is relevant to the eating was I remember the first day that I arrived and they're like, oh, do you want breakfast or anything? I was like, oh no, I've already eaten, and all the kind of lies. And then lunchtime came and I was like, no, you know, I'm not going to eat. And then tea time came and I was like, famished, like, you know, my stomach was grinding. I couldn't really concentrate. I was feeling really faint. And I realized that there was no way out. The nearest shop was 2.5 miles away. And even then it was just a little corner shop and we didn't have anywhere that we could prepare our own food. And all of the food that was on offer was just pizza, pasta, chips, and there was no calorie count on them. There was no even portion control. Somebody served you your portions. And I was just amazed how much it really affected me. I started having nightmares about donuts. I started setting my alarm in the middle of the night to do like exercises. I started trying to go as long as I could without eating. But then eventually when I did eat, I'd be like binging. But because it was in like communal halls, I'd be doing it in front of people and like food would be flying everywhere. And I was like, it's like the cookie monster of ketamine. I was like, rah, rah, rah. And people were like, oh, Jesus. And it was like quite horrible to watch. And then I started like getting this food and like trying to hide it in my room so that I could eat in secret. But then that like encouraged mice and people found out and it was really embarrassing. So I had to like, I wasn't allowed to like take food into my room anymore. And it was just really, it really kind of got to me. And that was like, whoa, maybe this is something that's not right. And then funny enough, I did it the next year and I remember already being anxious about it. And one of the teachers that was there sort of very openly said, oh yeah, like I've been in therapy for bulimia like 3 times. Have you ever thought you might be anorexic? And that was the first time that someone asked me if I've been anorexic rather than telling me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also the first time that someone had just said it in a normal way.
No, I think that's really key, what you've mentioned there. It can be an accusation.
Yes.
Because when you're living with something like anorexia, you're already being secretive enough.
Yeah.
You're already very actively trying to control your own narrative to the rest of the world.
Yes.
So then if someone crashes into that, telling you about yourself, I mean, most people would react to that badly.
Of course.
But then in that situation, it's going to be even more so.
Yeah.
And could really hold you back because you're so far rebelling from, no, they can't be right. These people are telling me what I am. I've got to, you know, got to figure out a different reason for all of this.
Yeah, big time. I completely agree with that. It's a weird old one. And a good example of that is like when I was at university, I had 2 mates and they were both big drinkers. I was a big drinker as well. I'm not proud of it. But I remember we were worried about both of their drinking. We went up to the first one and said, mate, like, a bit worried, like, you've been drinking quite a lot. And it was like, oh, really? And I was like, yeah, like, there's been a couple of, like, days this week you sort of, like, blacked out. And it was like, yeah, actually, good point. I suppose I hadn't really thought about that. Absolutely fine. Then went up to the next friend and it was like, mate, you know, sort of, you've been drinking quite a bit. Like, what do you know? You drink with me. Oh, why are you first suffering? And like, I was really aggressive. And like, he later went on to sort of be like, yeah, you know, I actually think I do have a problem with booze. I think it's exactly the same that sometimes you don't react in the situation that you would do on reflection. And actually, the more violent the reaction, perhaps the more that person does want to get rid of this thing or does want to be better, but they
or hide from the truth of it.
Or hide from the truth, you know, it's that kind of thing. But I think that is definitely a warning sign. And the fact that Diana had actually said to me, do you think you might be anorexic? It wasn't an accusation.
And how did coming to terms with it go from there?
a bit shit, really. I went home and I kind of accepted that I got anorexia, that I had it. I was like, put it in the past. So I was like, well, you know, and in the same way that like, you're like, do you remember that? Do you remember that year? I was a punk, yeah, I'm mental. And then just like carried on with my life, just sort of poodled along. And when I needed it, I relied on it more. The biggest relapse happened when I first started talking about it on stage. And the reason is, it would have been 2010 that I realised that I had it. And then like in 2014, I did the show about the anorexia. So for like 3 or 4 years on and off, I'd kind of been, you know, just using it. And I always wanted to do a show about anorexia because I love the ability that comedy has to sort of take the dark stuff and play with it. And I started doing this show. I then went full time in comedy, and loads of stuff is out of your control, like gigs, money, traveling, you know, it's all kind of very much taken out of your hands. And also the competitive nature, there's always going to be someone doing better than you. And in an industry where there is no clear career path, that made it even more difficult. But also, like, a very big reviewer up here just, you know, said to me in the loft bar one day, you know, I don't think you're really anorexic. I think you're a white middle-class man who has so much unchecked privilege. You need to create something in order to feel special.
Wow. And
I was like, okay.
Love to see inside that person's brain.
Wow, that person has experience of eating disorders. And it's just a very hateful, acerbic, right-wing person who used to be relevant and is trying to cling on to that bastion with all of her might. But
right.
It was that competitive thing. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm not doing well enough at it. And it became something that, yeah, just took over. And I basically didn't do anything about it until I had to go to the GP. And the reason I had to go to the GP was for the depression, not the anorexia. And I knew where this was all going. And like, I'd written all of the letters and I was sort of making all of the videos when I was like, you know, sort of completing the journey. And it was just like the GP that sort of said, look, you do realize that you can't get rid of the depression without the anorexia. And I was like, oh no. So then I kind of like engaged the treatment.
Were you noticing a kind of correlation there between finding your career difficult and then finding ways to put that competitive nature and that control into food instead?
Oh, hugely. Because like for me, the anorexia was above life. So if I didn't smash that gig at like the Standard, if I didn't get that paid gig, or if I hadn't got that audition, then none of that mattered. If I had got down an extra X amount, mm-hmm. or if I'd restricted for X amount of hours, or if I got by an X calories, it was something that was above life. It was, it was my religion almost. It was my kind of thing that just superseded and explained me. And if I couldn't make rent that month, then that was fine if I was, you know, restricting.
Yeah. And I think that's really important to mention, that when you're experiencing this to that level of severity, it becomes such an encompassing part of who you are that you can miss the distinction between who you actually are and who you are in relation to food.
I always said the anorexia was the best of me, and I genuinely believed that. I thought it made me flitty and silly and unanchored and stupid, and like, yeah, and stupidly I thought it helped make me creative and unique and like all of these horrible, terrible things. But the real reason is there was like a thunderstorm in my brain with the synapses going, fuck, you know, because they, you know, your brain takes at least 1,000 calories a day just to work. That's just one organ of your entire body, and if you're not sustaining that, then of course it's going to go into like shock, and it's just like, shit. It's like trying to run a national bank with like 4 people. They would just be like literally at their wit's end. It's exactly the same of trying to like manage your brain if it's not getting the right fuel. So yeah, it started shutting down, and I was really no longer Dave. I was the anorexic. And I think doing that show, loads of people kept on like warning me of like, do you really want to do this? And I was like, yeah, because I wanted to make it good. But it became my explanation, my bio.
It sounds almost like it was a new way to justify the condition. So at first it was the denial. And then once you had the show up and running, it became, oh no, I need it for this. It helps inform the show.
That, I mean, wow, that's an astute insight. I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. Yes, I think, and I think that was also like a sustainer as well. I remember there was one guy in the street, it was like really lovely. And I remember I was eating an apple in the street because I think everyone has different safe foods. Mm-hmm. One of my safe foods was like an apple. I remember this guy came up to me in the street and he was like, oh, by the way, mate, saw your show. And I was like, oh, you know, thanks for coming along. He's like, I really enjoyed it. It was really nice. Oh, thanks very much, mate. And he just went, oh, apple, bit of a fraud. And I was like, and I was like, oh yeah, no. And the thing is, I didn't want people to change how they were around me. I didn't want people to double check their language and triple check what they're going to say. But after that, I used to, if I had to eat, I would only ever eat in my room at home alone. Or I knew that I always needed energy before gigs. I used to eat in this shitty little toilet. And I remember a low point one Tuesday at the Fringe. The toilet had been blocked, but people had still used it. And I just got myself in and locked the door with like piss water up to my ankles just to eat this apple. And I was like, well, this is a new low, to be honest. It was, but I kind of, because I hid in plain sight, kind of, I got away with so much.
Yeah, and it's easier to think you're fixed then, because you're moving from the place of the sufferer to now the informer. And that's something I have to be really conscious of, having a podcast like this, that just because I can speak eloquently about mental illnesses, some of them I've had and some of them I haven't, doesn't mean that I then get to stop working on myself.
Yes.
And that's so important. And particularly with a condition like anorexia, it's one where I think recovery is the least linear. In that, I think for the most part, people don't recover from it. And I don't mean that in a depressing way. I mean it in that it so fundamentally can change the way you think and the way you behave entirely towards food, that you're not going to be able to just reset that. You're too far in. But in becoming conscious of what your behavior's like and what kind of triggers you have, and being able to check in on how healthy you are on any given day, you can essentially replicate recovery. But yes, I don't believe there's a cure for it. And that's why it can be so complicated. Because even now I notice new things. You know, I'm very good with my food these days, relatively, but there are still new things I find. Like, I realized recently that I've never told anyone I've had issues with food at a meal or before a meal. And I realized that wasn't a coincidence, because I knew they were more likely to watch me and I would feel uncomfortable. And my response to feeling uncomfortable about food would be to not eat, which would then make them pay even closer attention.
Yeah.
And so the more you work on yourself, the more you find these things to unpick. And so you kind of have to, rather than looking to be cured or fixed, you've got to look at, okay, how can I be aware enough that when symptoms do come up, I'm one step ahead?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I still hate that, talking about food around food. But I also think one of the things I really hate as well is that I worry that subconsciously we kind of glamorize eating disorders. Because like all of the stories that I read, a good example, when we were in year nine, we did this project on this guy called Nicky Cruz, right? And he used to be a gangster in the Bronx in New York. And I remember we did this project on him in RE, And I remember it just really, really vividly because it was the one project that, like, I loved RE, but all of our class, like, loved it. And they heard about, like, how if you were, like, in Nicky's gang, if you ran from him, he'd, like, stab you under the armpits and, like, and all of the ways that they'd, like, steal money and stuff. And the reason we did that project was he then actually went on to find God and become an evangelical preacher. But even the way that I've said that kind of shows you how the story was told. Like, oh my God, all of the gory stuff. There was that, oh, and then he found God. And I feel that we do the same with eating disorders. Of like, oh my God, I was surviving on this, I was doing that, I was at my worst. Oh yeah, then I got recovery. Anyway, the point, and I think that the narrative is very anorexia-based rather than recovery-based. And I really wish that when I'd have been out there, recovery wasn't seen as a punishment. It was seen as like, it's fucking cool, man. Like, use it as an... Yeah, no, I did. Just use it as an excuse to go out there, try different things, you know, face up to...
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost flipping it over. So you then create like a challenge out of eating. You're like, okay, I'm going to go find this new food type that I've never tried before. That's going to be my achievement for today.
Yeah.
And just flipping that round so that eating becomes the achievement.
And equally as well, something I'm really staunch on is like not just food as well. Like 1 year in, funny enough, at the Fringe, one of the seats of the anorexia was the anorexia helped numb me from unwanted emotions. I never liked being a sexualized bloke, and I never really liked that because I'm a heterosexual, and I always felt that, like, whenever I found a girl attractive, I was just as bad as those leches that, you know, my friends would complain about to me, like my friends that were girls. Like, oh my God, like, he's just staring at my boobs. And so many stories of men, you know, like strip clubs and be like, bleh. And I was like, I don't want to be that kind of bloke. And so I just tried to starve my sex drive by starving myself in part. And actually, like, I, you know, my wonderful therapist was like, you know, like, you don't, you know, girls can, like, enjoy sex too. People can enjoy sex too. It was great fun. It was, like, it was lovely. I really was. I was, like, 24, and I was, like, doing what most 16-year-olds do. But it was fun. It was enjoyable. It was like, a process. And I think that's exactly what recovery is. It's a process. And I think it's a process where you will fuck up. And, like, allow yourself to fuck up. Like, if you're setting yourself to be perfect, you're only going to fail. And, like...
Yeah, and then you'll fail and feel bad. And
exactly.
And then fall back to your own coping mechanisms.
I couldn't agree more.
So one last thing I just wanted to mention that you've reminded me of is earlier we were talking about the media influence.
Yeah.
And how it is a factor, but that doesn't necessarily equate it to being the cause. But I think certainly when it comes to recovery, it's so important to know. Because when you've already got into these unhealthy relationships with food, you're surrounded by things that can help you justify it.
Yes. Yeah.
So on that little callback to earlier in the episode, we'll finish up there. However, if people want to learn more about you, where should they go online?
You can go to my website, davechurner.co.uk, or I'm on Twitter, at davechurner. I'm not very good at Twitter. I'm terrible at selling myself. But yeah, people could buy, I've got a book out. It's called Weight Expectations. It's about anorexia. I wanted to call it The Real Hunger Games, but we weren't allowed. So yeah, you can buy it in Waterstones. It's called Weight Expectations.
Grand. All right. Well, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, mate. This is lovely.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.